Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Secretary of State Clinton said today the U.S. is giving full diplomatic recognition to Libya's main opposition group. Here in the studio with me, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Nadia Bilbasi of
MBC, Middle East Broadcasting Center.
Middle East Broadcasting Center, and Yoki Drizna of National Journal. Throughout the hour, we do invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning,
Diane. Good morning.
David Ignatius, how significant is it that the U.S. is now joining with some 30 other nations to acknowledge the opposition to Libya's Muammar Gaddafi?
It's important in two ways. First, as a piece of diplomatic symbolism, the fact that we're recognizing the Transitional National Council as the legitimate authority in Libya signals that we do not believe that some reconciliation with Gaddafi and his regime is possible. And so that it's a symbolic turning of the page, recognizing this new authority and saying the other authority is gone. On a more practical level, what this means is that the Transitional National Council, the rebels based in the east in Benghazi, are likely, it's a little more, bit more complicated than saying, well, definitely, but are likely to have access to the funds that have been frozen from Gaddafi's, from the government's accounts, that's estimated to total as much as $30 billion. And that's important because, in part, this Libya stalemate, which is what it is now a test of financial strength. Do the rebels have enough money to last the course, or will they be outdone by Gaddafi, who has money stashed away in cash, quite apart from this $30 billion in assets held outside the country?
And why now, Nadia?
Well, I think they were hoping that something will happen from within, inside the Gaddafi regime. Could be a defection from the army. It could be Gaddafi himself reaching out to leave the country. But these things have not materialized so far. The military power on the ground has not altered the reality. Although a long time ago they said that Gaddafi lost legitimacy, but now they realize that they have to do something. And this something is basically recognizing this TNC as a legitimate power to deal with, and therefore it will give them diplomatic push, and it give them, as David said, the release of the $30 billion that Gaddafi has in this country. And I think they just realized basically they have to change, they have to do something on the ground, and now they realize it is the time to do it.
Yogi.
Well, it's actually, I think, a little bit more than that. I mean, what it is, in my opinion, is a recognition that events on the ground have changed. This past week, beginning about 8 days ago, there have been a flood of stories coming out of both the U.S. press and the British press about Gaddafi having a cash crunch, relying more and more and more on African mercenaries, but lacking the money to pay them, that the price of gasoline in Tripoli has, depending on the estimate, tripled, quadrupled, quintupled, but that there are gas shortages, food shortages, that, you know, David alluded to a question of financial resources, but it wasn't a question recently that the two were roughly equal. The feeling everyone I've spoken to at the Pentagon who monitors this was things against Gaddafi have turned decisively in the past week, not on the ground militarily, but in terms of his access to money. And I think what this was is not simply a recognition, as I agree with David, that it was sort of a symbolic recognition that a page has turned, but it was also the administration has been very careful to not overstep on this. And it's led to a lot of criticism. It's led to accusations the U.S. was leading from behind, deferring too much to NATO, et cetera, et cetera. What's happened now is the administration has calculated that Gaddafi is not just losing legitimacy, but actually on the way out. And they're trying to accelerate and give it that last little push.
On the way out, David.
Well, that's certainly the hope. From the beginning of this crisis, if you've asked the White House, what's the strategy here, fellows, the answer is that we're going to squeeze Gaddafi, that his cash resources are limited. At some point during the summer, he's going to run out of money. The only caution I'd say to what – Yoki rightly says is a growing feeling that Gaddafi is weak, is that I interviewed an emissary from the Gaddafi circle several weeks ago who came to Washington trying to, you know, make contacts, make business, as it were. And he said, and I can't verify the credibility of this, that Gaddafi has within the country a lot more money than the U.S. realizes, that he has been hoarding cash so as to be able to pay bribes to the tribal leaders, so as to be able to pay his mercenaries in anticipation of precisely this sort of moment. Yoki and Yoki's sources may be right that that cash is dwindling much faster than the emissary said, but I note that the other side, as it were, says, no, we've still got money.
But let's assume that Gaddafi is dwindling in resources and stature as well. How soon, based on Secretary of State's Clinton's comments, how soon would the rebels likely have access to the money?
I think soon, because if you remember, the head of the TNC was in Washington a few weeks back, and they already have the support of the Senate. Senator Kerry was here, and he said he was supporting the release of the money. And I think it's a matter of just getting congressional green line to release the money. So I think they realize that they need it urgently. But I think I also wanted to add a point in terms of the TNC recognize it as the legitimate power in Libya. It also encourages, don't forget that these rebels only control the east part of the country.
Right.
And there is other parts that is being disputed. They hold it for one day, they lose it for the other day. So in a way, to come for the United States and say they are the legitimate power in this country, it means a lot of things. Also encouraging people maybe in Tripoli to defect and to say maybe you can join this government because now this is the government that you wanted to...
Will they be getting that news?
Yes, but I mean, I'm not quite sure how this is going to play out in Tripoli as well.
I mean, it is that's a great question you ask about in terms of can this be in some way blocked by the Libyan government. My feeling is probably not. I mean, there are enough uprisings in cities, even in the west, closer and closer to Tripoli, where not only is there communication coming in, but there's actual fighting more and more in the west of the country, not simply in the east. Two points I would make. One, the logistics of actually giving the money to the rebels, David alluded to this earlier, it's tricky. I spent some time talking to Treasury, even with this recognition, actually taking that money from the Treasury freeze and giving it to this quasi-government, it's not as simple as just assigning a piece of paper. It could take days, possibly weeks, till that happens. The other thing that I think is worth alluding to is that we don't know what Gaddafi... Let's assume that the reports are correct, that Gaddafi is running out of money for the moment. There have been some very alarming stories that haven't gotten much attention here because we're distracted by the debt ceiling, Casey Anthony, whatever. But there was a Russian envoy who went to see Gaddafi, went back to Moscow, and yesterday was interviewed by the Russian press about what is Gaddafi's state of mind. And again, easily mockable. We often think of him as a little bit crazy. It's also easy to see him as kind of a rational dictator who has held power for decades. But this Russian envoy said something that was kind of chilling. He said that Gaddafi's mindset right now is, if the rebels move into Tripoli, that he will burn the city down around them. Those were the words the Russian used. And what he was specifically talking about was, he said Gaddafi was willing to use the anti-aircraft batteries around Tripoli, basically to aim them straight up, fire a missile up, wait for it to crash down into Tripoli, that he would rather burn the city down around him than let the rebels take it. Some of that very likely is bravado. Some of that is very likely just chest pounding. But even now, in what may be the end game, it's very likely the end game will be messy and very bloody.
Whoa, David.
Well, I think we have to stand back and see the dimensions of this. We have a stalemate. And the United States is trying to create a sense of momentum, psychological as much as anything, so as to pull people away from Gaddafi, pull military units away, get people who were still contesting areas around Tripoli, along the kind of what amount to ceasefire lines, to come over. My own judgment, the crazier Gaddafi sounds, the more he sounds like a suicidal dictator determined to destroy his city around him, the more likely it is that we'll be able to get some of the generals who stayed loyal to him to come away. I mean, who wants to be there when Gaddafi decides it's time for the suicide bunker? So long, Muammar. You can send your missiles up to crash down in your head, but we're leaving. And that's precisely what we've been hoping. And I think I'd look over the next several weeks for more efforts to get that momentum going. Units coming over, big announcements. That's the kind of thing we should look for.
All right. Let's talk about the visit of our new Secretary of Defense, Leon, pardon me, Panetta, to Iraq. Tell us about it, Nadia.
Well, basically, this is the first visit. He's going there to nudge the Iraqi government to come up with a yes or no answer as whether they wanted the U.S. forces to stay in Iraq. As you know, this agreement that's signed by President Bush and Prime Minister Maliki will expire in December 31st. And it's called the Status of Forces Agreement, known as SOFA. So basically, he's saying in a very blunt language, like, you have to tell us, damn it, as he said. He used very colorful language in complete opposite of the soft-spoken former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. And they understand the complexity of the situation. The Iraqi government, led by Maliki, has a coalition, shaky coalition, of the Dawa Party, of the Sadr's groups, of the Kurdish nationalists. So it's a group together that they have to decide whether they want to keep U.S. forces or not. Now, on the street, I think the concept is very unpopular. They basically will reinforce what they believe, that the invasion of Iraq was to get hold of Iraq's vast oil revenues and to establish a military base in the heart of the Middle East in Iraq. My guess will be that they will come up with some kind of agreement by the end of the year, but probably regardless of how many troops will be left, whether it's 10,000 or 15,000, they still need to protect one of the biggest U.S. embassies in the world, which is in Baghdad. It has 5,000 personnel, intelligence, civil servants, etc. So they will have some kind of forces, but also it's a message to Iran that we're not going to abandon the country. It's not going to be your playing field. It's actually the U.S. who's going to have some kind of presence in Iran.
Now, Bill Basie of Middle East Broadcast Center. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. One of the biggest stories this week, aside from all the debt stories and arguments going on in this city, has been that regarding Rupert Murdoch and News Corp. And in fact, this morning we learned that Rebecca Brooks, the former editor of News of the World, has now resigned from News International. Up until now, Rupert Murdoch had staunchly defended her. What changed?
What's changed is that this scandal is something that he cannot contain. I mean, he has dealt with scandals his whole life. He sort of reveled in it. When there's an FCC ban barring him from buying newspapers and TV stations in New York, he beat it. When there have been other movements against him in America, in Britain, in Italy, he's beaten all of them. He's someone who loves to fight and has had success at it. This one may be a fight he loses. What's fascinating about this one is Rebecca Brooks was as close to him, actually probably closer than his actual daughter. He and his daughter had a falling out. His daughter's husband routinely criticizes him, bashes Fox News publicly and by name. So she was not just a surrogate daughter, but someone he had a closer professional relationship with than his own daughter. But what's very interesting to me is here, the focus is entirely on just the moral depravity of the phone hacking into a murdered girl's phone so her parents have hope because messages disappear, hacking into the phones of the spouses of dead soldiers, dead British soldiers from Iraq or Afghanistan. You sort of just shake your head and your stomach turns on it. But what's very interesting is that slightly lost in the hacking piece is there is a very, very real legal risk to the Murdochs personally. And that risk isn't the hacking. That risk is a law in the books here called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, FCPA, which makes it illegal to bribe, knowingly bribe, or if you're an executive, oversee the bribery of public officials in another country. Rebecca Brooks has publicly admitted back in 2003 and since that it was common for reporters at her paper to bribe police officers
in
England.
In England.
Metropolitan Police, Scotland Yard, bodyguards of the royal family. The two investigations going on now in Britain, one of them is focused almost entirely on the bribery of police officers. If it is established, and it is almost certain that it will be, that that was common practice within News International, bribing public servants, and that was known at senior levels of the company, that can and probably will lead to actual criminal indictments. The Obama administration has been more aggressive than any of its predecessors in indicting executives for bribery in other countries. So the phone hacking rightly gets a lot of attention because it's a huge story, it's vivid, it's kind of nauseating, but the bribery could be what is actually the key to the criminal side of this.
Nadia.
And also now we heard that Eric Holder is opening an investigation, the same with the FBI, and precisely that, to find out if money has been paid to anybody within the police force of New York, or even they're talking from the top to the janitor, as they said, to find out if they have been given this money to discover whether they wanted to know information that will lead to voicemails or lead to some kind of information of 9/11 victims that obviously newspapers like the News of the World of the Sun will kind of revered in and think that they have some kind of exclusive information about a private life of people who has been suffered as victims of one of the most horrific crimes committed. So I think it is it's going to be very serious. I mean, Rebecca Brooks now is going to testify in the British Parliament on July 19th.
Hasn't she already been subpoenaed here in Washington?
Yeah.
She has. And now, of course, because the story has broken in Britain more than here, but now the implication is coming to this part of the Atlantic that basically they wanted to find out. So many investigations been opened, demanded by four senators. Basically, they wanted to know what were the implication of the News of the World in the United States, especially with 9/11 victims.
David.
Well, like Yoki, I think that part of what makes this story so compelling is that Rupert Murdoch, as I wrote this week, he runs a company with a chip on his shoulder. He is a man who is so convinced that he speaks for the common man or woman, that his enemies are elitist snobs who stand for the establishment, for the traditional way of doing things, that he has increasingly over the years justified almost any behavior because he's doing it on behalf of the people. That's that sort of feistiness that you see on Fox and all of the Murdoch properties. And increasingly it seems as if in this hacking scandal, in the behavior of News of the World, the most extreme Murdoch property, you could argue, people really did go over the lines. And the question now is, what did higher-ups know about it? It's a classic cover-up investigation in terms of what Yoki was talking about a moment ago, whether there's exposure to Foreign Corrupt Practices Act charges in the United States. The first question is, did higher-ups know about the payments that were being made to the British police? I would just note, in terms of the issue that Yoki raised, while it's clear that payments were made to cops for information, for tips, that is a fairly widespread practice in British journalism, unfortunately. It was used a lot by the Murdoch publications, but they're not alone. The deeper question with the British police, the deeper corruption, I think, is whether senior officials who were in a position to oversee the investigations that were basically closed down, they got these two sacrificial lambs and sent them off to prison, and it isn't any wider, were the senior officials who allowed that very narrow investigation intimidated not by the receipt of money but by the fear that Murdoch's publications would expose their personal lives. And that's the I think the issue for top level British police.
What about the connection between what's happened in England and the Wall Street Journal and top officials there, Yoki.
If I could just add a quick point to David's. He's right that this is part. It's common part of tabloid culture. What's different is that News Corp is an American-based company. James Murdoch is an American citizen. So there is a legal liability here that there would not be for British citizens of British-listed companies. It's also worth pointing out, I think, that he made the very astute point about what did the leadership of Scotland Yard, why were they intimidated? One of the interesting and kind of disgusting aspects of this is the head of Scotland Yard, who had led what is widely derided now as a completely covered-up, watered-down investigation, as soon as he retired, went to work as a paid columnist for Murdoch. So one question is, was he intimidated? One question is, did he leave because he got a very lucrative job as a columnist for a Murdoch paper immediately after quashing this investigation? So it is just kind of layer upon layer of things that just make you either your stomach turn or your head burst with the absurdity of all of it. The question about the Wall Street Journal is an interesting one. I mean, as of now, there are no allegations that anyone in the journal did this kind of practice. I worked there 11 years. I never saw anything even remotely similar to this, even after the Murdoch takeover.
When did he take it over?
It's close to 3 years ago at this
point.
Okay. And for the most part, I think he's done a lot of good. I mean, a lot of us who have left, we still like the paper. We still care about it. He poured resources into it. The paper is bigger than it was before. But I think the question about the journal is a financial question. Murdoch's children, the shareholders of News Corp, they hated the purchase of the journal. They felt that he had overpaid considerably. He later wrote the purchase down by several billion dollars, so they were right. They feel as if the papers, which were Rupert Murdoch's obsession, account for about 3% of News Corp's revenues and aren't worth the headaches. And that's what they felt before there were criminal investigations by the FBI, criminal investigations in England, bad press day after day after day after day. So the question, I think, about the journal is, will there be pressure to sell, not by Rupert Murdoch, but by his children, by other News Corp shareholders? Will they just say, this whole mess is not worth the bother?
What about Fox News, David?
Well, Fox News is under attack for all sorts of issues.
But it's also owned by Rupert Murdoch.
I think the fate of Les Hinton, the CEO of the Wall Street Journal, of Dow Jones, is important because he's been such a close print lieutenant for Murdoch through his career. It is said that Les Hinton and Murdoch talk every day about issues that are important. I just would like to note one small example that illustrates the defiant attempt by News Corp, by Rupert Murdoch, to contain this scandal before it became uncontrollable. Last year, the New York Times wrote an excellent magazine article detailing everything that was known about this scandal and showing that it was completely implausible, that it was just two people who'd done this hacking, and that the claims that no senior editors or other higher-ups knew about it just were not to be taken at face value. Prior to the publication of that article, a News Corp employee named Bill Acas, who was the managing editor of News of the World, sent a series of letters to the New York Times, essentially trying to stop them from publishing the article. The sort of letters that we journalists all know that you get, which are attempts at intimidation. The Times went ahead. Its article was solid. After the publication, he wrote an indignant letter. How dare you? This just shows this is the elitist New York Times trying to attack its competitor. This is all about the Times versus the Wall Street Journal. In other words, there was total denial that there was anything wrong in this story, in the culture of these publications. If your listeners want to go back and trace a history, it's all on the New York Times website, and I would urge people to do it because you can see how this developed. You can see the attitude of mind.
Has this story become so big in part because News Corp is so big? It controls so much in this country, certainly, as we've said, the Wall Street Journal, Fox News. Is it a matter of competitiveness, or is it a matter of really worrying about the state of journalism?
I think worrying about the state of journalism. If you look at the News of the World, and I remember the years I lived in England, and The Sun, these are considered yellow journalism. It's not serious. I mean, the headline is basically all scandals, digging into the private lives of people. Nobody seriously that consider themselves kind of a good journalist will read this kind of publication.
But it's very popular.
Yeah, it's number one read. Yeah. I mean, the News of the World is this number one. It says so much about the British public, I guess. But I think it is is what kind of method that journalists use to obtain information. And considering, I mean, the Rebecca Brooks that we talked about, this is she comes from a very excellent background in terms of somebody who was very well educated. She went to the Sorbonne. She studied in France. She came back as the youngest editor. But they know how to entice the public with this kind of sources stories. And this is the success of the News of the World and of The Sun as opposed to The Guardian and others. But I think the problem here is not just this yellow, as we label them, the yellow journalism, but also a newspapers like the Sunday Times, which is very known for its investigative value. It's also now there's some investigation that maybe there is also they have been hacking into some lines. And that will also affect the deal that Murdoch is trying to get with Sky News. And he was trying to claim 60% of Sky, and now the deal is dead in the water. Obviously, he was not going to be able to do it. So I think his reputation has been tarnished. And to have one man in charge of all these publications from Australia to Britain to the U.S., I think it's a bit dangerous for journalism.
It's also, I mean, to get to your question, I think it's a question of reach. This is a man who controls not just newspapers, not just Fox News, 20th Century Fox, the movie studio, HarperCollins, the book publisher, all the Fox offshoots, multiple Fox Sports, dozens and dozens of media properties. And there's been a question about him for decades about what has he been willing to sacrifice to get there. He canceled a memoir written by the last governor of Hong Kong, the last British governor of Hong Kong.
Chris Patton.
Because he didn't want to upset the Chinese. When he was trying to get his satellite network into China, he agreed specifically to tone down what that network would cover. So there's been an intermingling of his business interests and his extraordinary journalistic holdings for decades.
Yoki Driessen, he's with National Journal Magazine. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And David, you wanted to add one comment.
Well, I just wanted to note the political implications of this. It's one of the shocking aspects of the scandal, frankly, has been how long it took British politicians to stand up to Murdoch. Murdoch's power in Britain, in British politics, was so enormous that politicians from all the major parties, but especially Labour and the Tories, chased after him, even though there was a cloud over Andy Coulson, an editor who'd been in charge of Murdoch Publications at the time of this part of this the supposed scandal was hired as a key Downing Street spokesman. So I think as we look at American politics, we're more resilient. You know, Fox News is very aggressive, but you can see the danger in concentration of media power in the hands of someone like Murdoch. Just by looking at Britain and how politicians behave.
I want to take one telephone call before we move on. Let's go to Mark, who's in Lillian, Alabama. Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning. I see this as a media war that parallels the political wars. And this is a story. It's an important story, but it's not. It's being blown out of proportion because it's a chance to knock down their competitor.
What do you think, Kyoki?
Respectfully, I could not disagree more strongly. I mean, you're talking about the biggest and most powerful media company on the planet, not just in the U.S., but in England, in Asia, in Australia. You're talking about criminality that potentially reaches to the highest ranks of a multi-billion-dollar company. That'd be a big story anywhere. One point that I wanted to make earlier, I got a very funny email yesterday from a friend of mine who said that Murdoch is the end of the Arab Spring, that there have been aging autocrats whose people fear challenging them, who fell one after the other, Mubarak in Egypt, Saleh in Yemen, and that Murdoch is the last autocrat. He was feared. Nobody wanted to challenge him. And now, as David said, there's sort of this a bit of a frenzy to try to, now that he's finally appearing wobbly, people who had been in fear of him for decades coming out of the woodworks to challenge him.
And now we have a report from the AP in London that Rupert Murdoch will take out a full-page ad in all of Britain's main national newspapers to apologize for the hurt caused by serious wrongdoing by journalists at his now defunct News of the World tabloid. It's going to be signed by him, Murdoch, and it says, News International is deeply sorry for the hurt. It adds, we regret not acting faster to sort things out.
This is the sort of, again, not trying to make light by over determining a comparison, but this is the too little too late that we've seen in other contexts all year. 2 days ago, Murdoch said he still stood by Rebecca Brooks. He angrily dismissed calls for her to go. Today she leaves. Yesterday he gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal where he said there were only minor mistakes. Those were his exact words, that he thought the company had handled it about as well as it could have, that, again, Rebecca Brooks had done nothing wrong. His son had done nothing wrong. He saw nothing, that he felt very little regret. It was sort of typical Murdoch, as David talked about, this man with a chip on his shoulder, kind of figuratively flipping the bird off to the rest of the country. And now, drip by drip, Rebecca Brooks, a day after she has his full confidence, she's gone. One day after saying he has no mistakes, he'll buy a full-page ad. But it's all too little, too late.
How seriously do you feel this is a threat to his ownership of this total media empire, David?
Well, I need to have a better grip on the financials of News Corp than I do. There is a big shareholder suit that is charging, essentially, that the shareholders have been misled consistently. That's a potent weapon, and if the company itself is charged in the U.S., that's even more potent.
David Ignatius, The Washington Post. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Every man at some point in his life is going to lose a battle. He's going to fight and he's going to lose. But what makes him a man is that in the midst of that battle, he does not lose himself.
On the next Fresh Air, we say goodbye to the critically acclaimed TV series Friday Night Lights and feature interviews with two of its stars. Join us.
And welcome back to the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. This week with Nadia Bilbasi. She's senior U.S. correspondent for NBC TV. Yoki Driessen is senior national security correspondent for National Journal Magazine. David Ignatius is columnist for The Washington Post. His latest book is titled Blood Money, a novel of espionage. We're going to open the phones now. First to Ryan in Kensington, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I would just like to comment about how
I think how terrible it is to have allowed Rupert Murdoch to gain this type of power internationally. And this is just a prime example of what free markets do. They he swallows up all of the other competition and becomes so powerful that he ends up buying legislators in England and as well as this country. And and what a catastrophe it is, and how perilous it is to attempt to take him on.
I think Ryan hits at a lot of the core of this. I mean, one of the questions that's causing the most soul searching already in England, and eventually we'll start here as well, is how much blame do British politicians deserve for this, for having not stood up to him sooner, for having not taken action sooner? A lot of this was not secret. I mean, the phone hacking has been known about for years. The bribing police was known about for years. It's new to the U.S. in sort of our understanding of it, but in England, politicians knew about this for years, but they were too afraid to challenge him. And that, I think Ryan is exactly right about that.
All right. To Ted, who's here in Washington, D.C., you're on the air.
I just wanted to go back to Yogi's comment earlier about what the Russians had heard from Gaddafi's people. And I think that's something that should be taken seriously, because I think that if you corner a rat, a rat's going to act like a rat. And if he does something really crazy like that, I have to really question whether or not it's worth it to have international intervention in there in the first place. And what would we have gained other than the blood of the people of that city, you know? And I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks for calling, David.
Well, I've actually met Gaddafi in Tripoli briefly, and I can say that he is the most bizarre-looking leader I've ever met.
He came
in with wild, bloodshot eyes. He was supposed to give me an interview, stormed into this room, walked right up to me about 6 inches away from my nose, looked at me, and then stormed out of the room. And I wondered, did I say something? Well, but he was completely bizarre behavior.
Did you ever get the interview?
No. He never came back.
You would have benefited if you were a female reporter to whom he was over-friendly years.
He was famous for taking my female colleagues to his tent and closing the door and stroking their hair and saying, telling them they look like his first wife and creepy stuff.
Wow.
So anyways, that's just a little background.
Creepy.
It's like a News of the World headline.
Yeah.
The notion that somebody can threaten suicide and threaten the suicide of his city and people, and for that reason we should let him off because he's acting so crazy, I think is completely wrong.
All right.
And the more he makes these threats, the more seriously people say we must do something about it.
Let's move on to Syria, because earlier this week, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that the Syrian president had lost his legitimacy. How have those words affected the whole outlook toward Syria?
Well, first of all, this is a deja vu. It is we get used to the Secretary of State saying the regime is stable, or they stay silent, and they use the repeated word of basically people have the universal right to assemble and to demonstrate peacefully. And then they realize there's not much they can do, so the regime lost legitimacy, and now they're not even calling for him to step down because they don't know how can they pack these words with action? They cannot. So basically, she's coming now, which is the strongest language we heard so far. It provoked a reaction from the Syrian government saying, who are you to tell us who give us legitimacy and who's not? But obviously it came in the wake of this attack on the U.S. embassy and the French embassy as well, after Ambassador Ford went to Hama, which is, as you know, in the context of Syrian history, is a very tricky city. Bring us back to 1982 when the father, President Assad himself, trying to uproot a religious or Muslim insurgency, killing in the process, according to Human Rights Organization, could be up to 20,000 people. But in the process, they uprooted the uprising, but they probably took, as they said, one man from each family of Hama. So people now remember that time 30 years later, and they're coming back to say, we are protesting again. And we've seen in these patterns, it's just unbelievable, the courage of the Syrian people. It's on a daily basis, they lose 20 and 30 people, and the regime comes and hit back. And now they come into other option, which is the national dialogue, which is mainly government officials with few independents, but there is no way out, really.
Well, the U.S. is being gradual in its statements. I actually think that's appropriate. There have been calls for the United States to withdraw its ambassador, Robert Ford, from Damascus. I think that would be a mistake. I thought that the decision to send Ford along with the French ambassador to Hama, where the terrible massacre occurred in 1982, in effect to say the world is watching. We are here to bear witness to what's going on. I thought was a terrific move, and you can't do it if your ambassador isn't there. I thought the Syrian overreaction storming the American and French embassies just showed how desperate they are. I do think that the issue that the U.S. needs to be thinking about is, can you create a process of transition away from this brutal, autocratic, corrupt regime towards democracy without thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people getting killed? People who know Syria say that the ethnic violence there could be as bad as or worse than Iraq if it gets out of control. And so it's something that you need to be very careful about. You need to be careful about rhetoric. You need to be careful about making statements that you can't back up or that you can't back down from. That's why I personally think that the administration's caution has been appropriate. But the real issue now, I think, is how do you build a process that leads to a new Syria?
I think that part of the gradualism, I agree with everything David said, but I think part of the reason why you've seen this kind of measured gradual response is we frankly don't have very many good options.
Right.
There's no interest. We don't have the military resources to use force. No one wants to be involved in a military action in Syria. Assad is very smart. His money was not in American banks the way Gaddafi's was, so financial sanctions are having virtually no impact on his family. They are pressuring some of his supporters and sort of Syria's merchant elite, but they're not hitting him. So we just don't have that much we can do. The other thing that I just wanted to mention in reference to Nadia's point earlier, we talk so much on this show about very depressing topics, you know, venality, greed, corruption, bribery. The bravery of Syrians, especially in Hama, where not only do they know in a kind of abstract sense what Assad, that family, is capable of and willing to do, but they lived through what that family is capable of and willing to do, is, to my mind, sitting in a distance safely in this studio, it's breathtaking. These are people going to the same streets where, not that long ago, he massacred much of a city. They know what that family is willing to do to them, and they go out, as Nadia said, day after day after day. And it's, at the risk of sounding kind of sappy, it's very uplifting to watch from a distance.
All right, let's talk about South Sudan, which became a country on Saturday, a UN member yesterday, the 193rd UN member. How significant is this, Nadia?
Well, it's significant because it's, as you said, the newest country, but it could be the poorest country in Africa. But it ends almost 50 years of war, the last since the civil war started in the 80s. 2 million people died. And I think there was no way out. It basically came out as a referendum according to the 2005 peace agreement between the North and the South, sponsored or brokered by the Americans in Naivasha, which is give the South the right to secede if they wanted to. And of course, they did, as we have seen. The problem for the South is it's going to be huge, immense challenges in every single front, basically. It's a rich country in oil and in minerals and in forests, and they have so many things to give. The problem, they have no infrastructures, they have no hospitals, they have no roads. And the main thing, which is the oil, is they have to be exported through a pipe to Port Sudan, which is in the north. So they have to have some kind of deal whereby the oil has to go through the north. Alongside that, you have conflict on the borders, you have fighting between tribes. You have mass graves, you have human rights abuse within the army that has to make that transition from a rebel movement to an army to protect the South. They have so many problems, but the fact that they have broke away and they were established by the bliss of the international community, who has invested interest in seeing South Sudan as a new young state with Juba as its capital, I think it gives some kind of legitimacy for the people who fought so long to break away from the South, who discriminated greatly against them.
And here's a comment on our website. We all know the troubled history of democratic governments in African nations. What can or should the international community do to support a successful and truly democratic government in the Republic of South Sudan? David.
Well, financial assistance obviously would be part of that story, helping them to make arrangements for export of oil. I just was with an international oil chief executive who was talking about Sudan and the ways in which the resources there can be developed. That would be the best thing, is if the country had real sources of financial support. You know, I look at countries that have been torn up that recover, and I'm thinking of Rwanda, just to the south of South Sudan. And what seems to be necessary is a strong leader, sometimes a leader who's so strong that there are human rights questions that are raised, a strong army that keeps order in the country so that the country feels secure, and then international oversight and support where people are, if the government's going too far, people will criticize it. They'll support opposition movements, help them to get going. So you'd hope that all those things would come together in South Sudan, as, in my judgment, they have in Rwanda.
All right. Two other things, and I don't know if there's any connection. The murder of President Karzai's half-brother in Afghanistan and the bombings in Mumbai. Yoki.
I mean, on the first one, the murder of Ahmad Wali Karzai, several of us have met him. He was charming, spoke fluent English, lived in my beloved hometown of Chicago. So we talked about the Cubs and his favorite restaurants, which was kind of surreal in this palatial house in Kandahar. What's interesting to me about his death is he was derided as being the worst of Afghanistan. And people said, he's corrupt, he has ties to the drug trade, we need to build Afghan politics, with the idea, with the implication that Ahmad Wali Karzai and his mode of business was different than Afghan politics. That betrays our ignorance. Ahmad Wali Karzai's way of life was Afghan politics.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
This was a man who knew how that country worked. We don't like it. It's corrupt. It involves payoffs here, bribery there, flattery there, this kind of delicate balancing act between business executives, tribal leaders, guys with guns. But he knew how to work that system. His death is a much bigger story than I think we realize.
What interests me about Ahmad Wali Karzai is that this is a devil that the U.S. learned how to live with. If you go back 2 years, you found a great consternation among U.S. officials in Afghanistan about him. He was so corrupt, links to this one and that one. I was in Afghanistan 2 weeks ago, and I talked to the senior civil coordinator in Kandahar, Ahmad Wali Karzai's home, and he was just raving about how effective Ahmad Wali Karzai had been in making, establishing tribal contacts and helping us stabilize the province of Kandahar. It was key to any success we were having there. He'd gone from being this kind of corrupt warlord, drug lord, to being our best interlocutor. So that's an illustration of how our strategy there has bent. If it's true that the Taliban got to one of his closest aides, you know, someone with deep tribal connections,
and
to him.
A friend,
right?
Someone
he
protector,
trusted.
You know, who protected his lands, his family, and turned him. We have a very interesting story this morning in the Washington Post about how this man, Mohammed Sardar, seems to have made a trip to Quetta in Pakistan and come back very shaken up. Something happened. Did the Taliban turn him? How did they do it? How did whoever did it get an assassin in that room with one of the most powerful men in Afghanistan?
And the bombings in Mumbai.
The city becomes accustomed to this kind of bombing. It's been going on since the 90s. Some will say it's a failure in Indian intelligence to detect it. This current one led to the death of about 21 people. It hit the financial capital, the commercial capital, and it basically targeted people in rush hour as they wanted to do maximum damage. And it looks like nobody claimed responsibility so far, but it looks like it's made of some kind of bombs where, according to forensic evidence collected from the scene, made of ammonium nitrate, which anybody can buy, I guess, in the market with a local timer. Some will say that it might be a local mujahideen, Indian mujahideen group, or Al-Ashkar-e-Tiba, who active, obviously, there. If it's been linked to Pakistan, that will be more serious issue. It reminds us of what happened in Mumbai in 2008 when we saw the attacks in the hotels and cafes. It is a complicated picture of the relationship between India and Pakistan that always remind us of that tension between the two countries. But Mumbai, sadly, always seems to be the target of such attacks. I don't know, you know, what more to say except that sometimes these incidents cannot be prevented, even if you know and you have information of certain groups, that sometimes you cannot prevent them because, as I said, it can be done on a very local level of buying materials, and if you meant to cause maximum damage, you can actually do it easily.
Is Afghanistan going to try to find out, try to look farther into the assassination of Karzai's brother?
Definitely. And the tensions, David hit it on the head. I mean, not only the question about the Taliban, but the question about what role did Pakistan play in this? I mean, if he went to Quetta, if something happened to him in Quetta, the Karzai government has been firmer and firmer and firmer in saying to the U.S., you're fighting the right war in the wrong place, which we tend as a country now to agree with. You have to fight it in Pakistan.
Yoki Driesen of National Journal Magazine, Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, his newest novel, Blood Money, a novel of espionage. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Katie June Friesen answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.